Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When you think of the word slavery, what comes to mind? Probably African slavery. Textbooks, memoirs, and movies reinforce the notion that all slaves were Black Africans imported into the New World. Along with most other historians, today's guest, UC Davis Professor Andres Resendez, assumed that the real story of exploitation in the New World involved the 12 million Africans carried across the Atlantic. But as he kept collecting sources on Indian slavery in Spanish, Mexican, and U.S. archives, he began to see things differently. Indian slavery never went away, but rather coexisted with African slavery from the 16th all the way through the 19th century. In his new book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America, Andres Resendez writes that it was a system of bondage that targeted Native Americans, a system that was every bit as terrible, degrading, and vast as African slavery. Yet most Americans are not aware of it or learn about it at school. From the days of Columbus to the beginning of the 20th century, from Haiti to California, between 2.5 and 5 million natives were enslaved across the Americas, in stark contrast to the African slave trade, which consisted primarily of adult males. The majority of Indian slaves were women and children. So why is there little known about Native American slavery, and what are the ripple effects of that legacy today? Andres Resendez is professor and historian at UC Davis, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Andres. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is really great to have you. This hit really close to home for me because my grandmother, who recently passed away, is a California native. She grew up in Ukiah. So thank you for exposing this untold history. I understand that you first started really thinking about these issues when you were working on your last book, A Land of Strange.
That's right. That book was about three Europeans and one African castaways in the New World in the 1530s. And they were enslaved by natives in the area around Florida for a period of 6 years. They finally refashioned themselves into healers, and then they essentially walked across North America, the first outsiders to do so. And in looking for some context for that story, I started thinking about, so how come they were enslaved by the Indians? What kinds of institutions did they have to enslave Indians? It was all the more puzzling because many Indians actually refused to enslave them, in part because these were nomadic groups, small nomadic groups, and they refused to essentially feed more mouths. Especially these Europeans would have been laughably incapable at hunting or sustaining themselves. So the benefits that they would produce would be offset by the cost of keeping them alive. Subsequently, they fled their enslavement, and they walked across North America. And the first people that they ran into were not, other Spanish colonists, etc., but they were Spanish slavers. By then, these Europeans had become like rock stars. They were followed by 1,000 Indians who perceived that they had healing powers. And these European slavers essentially wanted to take all of these Indians for themselves. And there was a showdown between these castaways and the Spanish slavers. That made me realize that this is the cutting edge of the Spanish Empire in North America. These slavers is a big story that we haven't told.
Your book is meticulously researched. I mean, you have quotes from so many people, and there's just so much information in here. How did you begin to tackle such a massive topic? I mean, you point out in your book that there are about 15,000 books on African slavery, and yet when we're talking about Native American or Indian slavery, there are just a couple dozen monographs devoted to this issue. So how did you begin to tackle this?
Yes. My initial idea was to do a more restricted, more contained book. The more I learned about it, the more I realized that the best service I could do to the public and to the profession at large was to point to the larger story, to do the big picture, because as you just noted, there are many local stories and monographs dealing with this subject. And these Indian slaves do loom in these stories, but it is very easy to dismiss those and say, well, a couple of dozen Indian slaves here and a couple of dozen there don't really add too much. So eventually, as I went through the process of researching this book, I became persuaded that the best thing I could do was to try to come up with this big estimate and to try to provide an outline of the whole system of enslavement that loomed over North America for four centuries, and that really is it's a very complicated story. That it's a moving story. It begins in the Caribbean, it moves into the silver mines of northern Mexico, and it winds up in what is now the American Southwest and Southeast. And so I just wanted to tell this big story.
Well, and so based on the research you did, you also came to believe that slavery played a more significant role than epidemics like smallpox in decimating indigenous populations.
Right. Well, I was quite interested in this subject in the Caribbean. The Caribbean has a very, of course, peculiar geography in that this archipelago had a very significant Indian population, yet these populations lived in very small islands where it was very difficult to run away. So the very geography of the Caribbean made it especially vulnerable to Spanish slavers. And at first, Indian slavery was outlawed except in a few exceptions. So, for example, Indians who were cannibals could be legally enslaved by the Spanish, or Indians who had other Indians captives. The Spanish were actually able to purchase these Indians and legally keep them as slaves. So because of these loopholes, essentially the earliest Spanish slavers were able to decimate the population of the Caribbean. If you look at the sources, they all talk about these tremendous violence in the Caribbean. Yet, 50 years ago, we started thinking about, so how could these large population of Native Americans disappeared so fast? And that's when the first ideas about large-scale epidemics came about. But as I show in the book, if you really look at, for example, the first 25 years, so the first large-scale epidemic really occurred in 1518, so 25 years after Columbus. So if we really look at these first 25 years, you realize that the population was already heading towards a collapse in this area, and there are no reported massive events of mass death. So that's where it became to dawn on me that that a lot more than just the epidemics was going on at the time.
Right, that's what most of us learn about in school.
Right, exactly.
How do you think? I mean, when you look at what people learn about in school, I mean, we don't learn that much at all. But how do you think that should change?
Well, I mean, I should say that as a historian, I have to say that in history, oftentimes people say, "How can we forget this?" and how can we forget that?" Well, we forget most of history, really. But this is a major story. This is a massive story, and I think it's important to remember it because today the kinds of human trafficking that go on can be traced more directly to these forms of bondage that I'm talking about, rather than a system like African-American slavery that was sanctioned by states. Today, slavery is outlawed all over the world, yet 35.8 million human beings around the world are enslaved in these other types of activities that pose as legal labor arrangements, yet they are akin to slavery. So that's the story that I wanted to tell, and that's the continuity that is worth remembering.
Because so many of us are familiar with African slavery, can you talk a little bit about the similarities and the differences? One major contrast is that adult males were mainly enslaved when you're talking about Africans, but the majority of Indian slaves were women and children.
Absolutely.
In fact, women were sold for more than men.
That's right. Women were worth up to 60% more than men, followed by children, little girls, boys, and then adult males were considerably cheaper in the markets in the Caribbean, in New Mexico, and as far south as Chile. So this is a price premium that continued for centuries and can be detected in many parts of the Americas. So that's a very interesting point.
And then on the women, can you just elaborate
sure,
on this?
Sure.
You write that this is the case because of sexual exploitation and women's reproductive capabilities. In this regard, Indian slavery constitutes an obvious antecedent to the sex traffic that occurs today, but there are other reasons too. In nomadic Indian societies, men specialized in activities less useful to European colonists, hunting, fishing, than women, whose traditional roles included weaving, food gathering, and child rearing.
Yeah. Yes. In the same way. Yeah. So women were more valuable, and again, it's a matter of perspective, because if you look, we may get into this later on, but many Indians were actually sent to Europe as slaves to Spain. Thousands of Indians were sent as Spain, These Indians who were sent to Spain were overwhelmingly women. They were given work as weavers, and they joined households where there were other slaves from other parts of the world that were also overwhelmingly women. So the type of slave meant for domestic service were often women and children rather than adult males, the type of plantation economy that we have in the New World. So in some ways, these peculiar, if we want to call it, gender balance is actually not as peculiar. It's actually more the norm of domestic slavery throughout the Mediterranean. So there was a majority of African women in Mediterranean households in cities like Genoa or Venice or Seville, etc., that had lots of slaves. The same thing goes for Eastern Mediterranean slaves. Many of them, the majority of them were, and sometimes the vast majority of them were actually women. So again, it is a little bit of our historical myopia. This is more the norm of preferring women and children rather than adult males. Adult males are only valuable when you have a plantation where you need physically demanding labor, sometimes it was also the case in the mining enterprises, even though in that case also children were valuable because they could crawl into small places where adults would not be able to do so.
Can you talk more about the Indian slaves that were sent to Spain? Again, it was illegal there, and there are records of Indians taking their masters to court to fight for their freedoms, and you have a number of accounts with Indian voices describing what that was like.
Right. So one of the most fundamental distinctions between African slavery and Indian slavery is the fact that early on the Spanish crown outlawed Indian slavery. So it happened. It happened by the millions, as we've said, but it happened clandestinely. It was illegal. And because of that, Indians who were held as slaves had the law on their side. And the Spanish crown, unlike, for example, the antebellum South, where the notion that an African slave would sue his or her master would have been laughable, in the case of many of these Indians held in households, they were actually able to go to Spanish courts and demand that they be freed. And this is what happened in Spain in the 16th century. So initially, Indians, so this is a little bit, bear with me, I need to say a couple of things.
Please.
For context, which is initially Indian slavery was legal except in a couple of it was legal. But then in 1542, the Spanish crown outlawed Indian slavery completely without any exceptions.
And why was that?
Because by the time the Caribbean had been completely decimated, the Indian population had been wiped out. And so a group of Spanish activists gathered around the Spanish court. They told the king and his ministers about all of these atrocities that had taken place in the Caribbean, and they decided to start a new compact with the indigenous population, in part because they didn't want to completely annihilate the Indian population of the New World. And so they issued the so-called New Laws, which was a new compact. It was meant as a new compact with the Indian population of the Americas. And it outlawed Indian slavery, and it put the Spanish legal system at the disposal of Indians who were enslaved. So the cases that we are mentioning in Spain occurred in the aftermath of the passage of this law. Masters in Spain who had Indians in their households were asked to come to the courts and present the corresponding documentation to see whether the Indians that they were holding were legal or not. And in many cases, the Indians were asked to come forth if they felt that they were being illegally held. In Seville today, there are about 100 legal cases of Indians who took their masters to court demanding for their freedom. Some of these proceedings, judicial proceedings, are about 800 pages. These are enormous proceedings that call in witnesses, etc., to try to attain their freedom. And so that gives you a sense of, even though these Native Americans were halfway around the world, they were still have the presence of mind to fight for their freedom. And in most cases, they actually gained their freedom.
Is this well known in Spain? Because you also write in your book that Queen Isabella emerged as an early champion of Indian rights. As Columbus kept insisting on his plans of enslavement and his men continued to ship Indian slaves in one guise or another, Isabella became exasperated. All along, she had been extremely supportive of the admiral, but by 1499, when she learned of the arrival of yet more Indians, she famously exploded. "Who is this Columbus who dares to give out my vassals as slaves?" Isabella and Ferdinand freed many Indians and, astonishingly, mandated that many of them be returned to the New World.
Absolutely. Columbus comes out very badly in this study. Columbus was one of the early slavers of the New World, the earliest, the original slaver of the New World. He, before his major voyage of discovery, he had traveled to Africa. He had been to the largest, the most important Portuguese outpost in Africa, in the coast of Ghana. And he had seen how it was possible to make money out of trading human beings. And when he arrived to the New World, he had an interest. He had a percent. He controlled about 25% of the marketable goods that could be found in the places that he discovered. And he found precious few. He didn't find silk that he was, I mean, the idea was to open the way to the Orient, but he didn't find any silk. He didn't find any of those things, but he found a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so early on, he sent, as I mentioned there, a caravel loaded to capacity, more than 400 Indians, more than half of whom perished on the way. So he inaugurated the Middle Passage, but this is the reverse Middle Passage, right, from the New World to Europe. And he, along with some questions for his monarch, saying that these Indians would make fantastic slaves. And he repeated that phrase over and over. So he was the original, amongst the original slavers. However, to their credit, the Spanish monarchs had to study this, whether the Native Americans were an enslavable people. Europeans, especially Mediterraneans, by then, by the late 15th, early 16th century, had slaves from many parts of the world. But before the slaves could be legally sold in markets in the Mediterranean, they had to be examined. The slaves had to be examined by officials and had to be determined whether these individuals had been obtained in properly declared wars and were enemies of the European nations. Otherwise, they could not be legally enslaved. And so the Spanish monarchs had questions as to whether Native Americans, who, after all, they were not waging an offensive war on the Europeans, they were not Muslim, which was another major reason why Africans were being enslaved, but they were pagan. So on the face of it, Native Americans didn't seem as enslavable as other peoples closer to the Mediterranean. And so to their credit, especially to the credit of Queen Isabella, she emerged as a defender of the Indians from very early on. So the way the Spanish crown dealt with this is that Indians are enslavable only in certain circumstances, only if they are cannibalistic, only if they are already held by other Indians as captives. And after 1542, even those loopholes were closed. So for the most part, this was an illegal activity.
We're speaking today with UC Davis Professor Andres Resendez about his new book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments, the toll-free number is 866. This is a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls. Join us live weekdays at 10 a.m. ORG. You have this brutal explanation of the ships on which Indians were loaded, packed into the space between below decks. The scene in the hold of a slaving ship was infernal. Lack of air, poor provisioning, and the relentless tropical heat magnified the slaves' suffering to the highest degree. A young man from Milan said the Indians could not move, and there they lay like animals amid their vomits and feces. When the sea was calm and the ship could not move, sometimes there was no water for these poor people. Broken down by the heat, the bad smell, and the discomforts, they died miserably down there. Is this in the history books in Spain? Do people in Spain learn about these things?
Some of it is in the history books. The Caribbean, so the passage that you read refers to the Caribbean. The Caribbean had the misfortune of having some of the early and big gold fields of the New World, and the large island today shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic, called Hispaniola or La Española, was the first home of the Spanish there, and that's where those mines were. Since there was no other workforce but the Indians, the Spanish very early on took these Indians and put them to work in the mines, but they died out very quickly. And so that prompted a series of slaving voyages all to the surrounding islands. And this is what that passage is referring to. Because there were so many Indians, and because there was so much gold, and because this required a lot of work, many of these Indians were simply taken in these passages. What's striking to me is that the passages from some of these islands to La Española were just a few days, you know, less than a week, sometimes a little more than a week. Yet the mortality rates in those ships sometimes reached all the way to half of them. Half of them were dead, which is a much higher mortality rate than what we see across the Atlantic in the Middle Passage, which suggests to me that there was very little provisioning, there was little water, and the idea was just to get as many Indians as possible, and the cost mattered less to some of these ruthless, very early ruthless slavers, Spanish slavers.
You also write that the attackers literally carried off entire populations, leaving empty islands in their wake, completely empty.
Completely empty. Yeah, an incredible thing that by the 1550s, so merely two generations after Columbus, 60 years after Columbus, some of these islands had been completely depopulated. Spain paid for this because many of these depopulated islands were subsequently colonized by French and British pirates, and that's where they established their own bases. By that time, many of these islands, had been completely devoid of Native Americans.
Today we're speaking with Andres Resendez about his new book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Thank you.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Andres Resendez. He is a professor and historian at UC Berkeley, and he is out with a new book called The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. He writes that it was a system of bondage that targeted Native Americans, a system that was every bit as terrible, degrading, and vast as African slavery, yet most Americans are not aware of it or learn about it at school. If you have any questions or comments for Andres about his findings and this book, which exposes this untold history, we'd love to hear from you. 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. Cater, how do you approach teaching about Native American history? 866-798-8255. And then what about learning what actually happened to Native Americans? How does it affect your perspective about history and where we live? The whole chapter is dedicated to California. So much happened in our backyard, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we leave Spain, Andres, you've got stories of people fighting back, and you have one really interesting woman, Beatriz. Can you talk about her or maybe another story that really stands out for you?
Sure. Well, that was an incredible story. This was a short woman who was missing a tooth, as she is described in the sources, who was already carrying a baby. And she was given as a wedding gift to an up-and-coming family in a little town close to Seville called Carmona, which happened to have many Native American slaves. What's really striking about it is that she lived for several years. I can't remember how many, like 17 years. And finally, Beatriz, after having suffered a number of things, including that the owner sold away Simon at a very early age because the owner believed that Simon had stolen from him, she decided that enough was enough. She had heard that many Indians were being liberated in Spain, that the holding of Indian slaves was illegal in Spain. And so she fled, went to neighboring Seville, met with some Spanish procuradores, so these officials who had been put in charge of helping Native Americans with their cases. And when everything was ready, trial ensued. The owner was called to Seville to answer for this charge of illegal enslavement. Beatriz needed to prove that she was from a part of the New World that was a Spanish colony, because Indian slavery by then, this is the second half of the 16th century, that was an illegal practice. However, if she was from the Portuguese side, or if she was from Northern Africa, then she could be legally enslaved, because peoples from these parts could be legally enslaved. And so what we have is an extraordinary trial, very detailed trial, in which Beatriz calls witnesses to prove that she is from one of the Spanish colonies. But of course, as in many cases with these slaves, they were brought when they were children. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes they didn't know how to speak indigenous languages. They recalled practically nothing about their homelands. And on the other side, you had very cunning lawyers hired by the owner who was trying to play on the gullibility of Beatriz. So the lawyer would ask leading questions like, are there lions where you're coming from? With the intention, obviously, of showing that she was actually from Africa rather than from the New World. Or were there camels? What kinds of fruits were there? Can you speak a language? And unfortunately for Beatriz, it went badly for her. Her witnesses were all over the map. They couldn't agree of exactly where she was from. She could not quite speak any indigenous languages. So she lost the trial. And so after defying her master, she was placed back in the custody of her master, and we can only imagine what the consequences may have been. But what's really interesting about this case is that Beatriz's daughter a feisty 17-year-old, carried this and years later also sued for her freedom and went through the same procedure. So all of these to talk about how incredible some of these documents are, how these courtroom dramas of the 16th century that really give us a little bit of more the detail and the personal stories of these often, I mean, I call them Indian slaves. I know very little about their lives, but in some of these, I do get some of these real glimpses of their lives in these kinds of judicial proceedings.
Andres Resendez is author of the book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. And you can join us at 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. So let's talk about what happened here in the United States. You write that in 1833, the Mexican government had mandated dismantling of the Spanish missions that had long served as California's social and economic backbone. Mission Indians were to receive plots of land, seeds, cattle, and tools. The predictable result was a land grab, and wealthy and well-connected individuals took the lion's share of this land. And you write about Mariano Guadalupe Vallejo, a ranching baron. You write about him and the Native Americans he enslaved on his compound in Sonoma, California. Tell us about him.
Well, the Vallejo, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to pronounce it. Was a very one of the leading families of Northern California. He was a very gregarious man. He invited all foreigners to came around to his house, and many of them, that's how we know about his, you know, living arrangements. So I write, for example, that in his big house, in his Casa Grande, as it was called, his children had, in a custom that was very, very reminiscent of what went on in the antebellum South, had one Indian slave dedicated to the every needs of each child, and that Vallejo's wife also had two Indian slaves dedicated to her every needs. And in addition to that, in the house, there was a staff of dozens of Indians working in various capacities, making tortillas, killing animals, cooking, mending, etc., doing all the work. Don Mariano's younger brother, Salvador Vallejo, was also very, very explicit about many other, you know, upper-class California families having staffs of Indians of anywhere between 20 and 60, up to 60 Indians. And he was also very clear about the fact that that many Native Americans were the ones who did all the work. Mariano Vallejo had a very large Petaluma ranch that was worked by about 600 to 700 Indians who lived in a community inside the ranch, and they did all of the work, construction work, all of the cleaning work, all of the harvesting, all the work that needed to be done there. We also know that Mariano Vallejo was also in charge of the militia in Northern California. And being in control of any military body in this frontier environment was an enormous advantage, because it meant that he could actually launch expeditions against quote-unquote marauding Indians. And that resulted in the capture of some of them who were given out as slaves or brought to work in his properties. There are various works that clearly lay out how various Mexican ranchers actually conducted raids, slaving raids, from the Bay Area communities, Spanish communities, further to the north, especially into the Napa Valley, and further north into the Clear Lake region, to bring back Indians. And these were not, you know, extraordinary occurrences. These were yearly occurrences. Sometimes multiple raids were made in a single year, as there are records of those.
Yeah, and this is very brutal. I mean, these names are right in our backyards. Mm-hmm. You write about Captain Sutter, who brought Fort Ross, who bought Fort Ross. He enslaved Indian children. Salvador Vallejo, who set a building on fire with Indian men inside. Andrew Kelsey. Charles Stone, who would flog Indians for entertainment and rape young Indian women. And yet, this history is not really known in this part of California.
Well, that's right. I mean, I myself, I'm a historian. I lived for a while before moving to Davis. I lived in Orinda, and little did I know that this was a part of these Indian slavery network that formed especially in the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s. We are often in California very focused on the future and technology, and we know a lot less about our past, especially about this very sordid past that we do have as well.
You have so many brutal quotes from people who were very honest about their feelings about Native Americans. Is this information easy to find?
It is easy to find. I mean, there are many books that tell this story in bits and pieces. So to me, it is not hard to find good quotes. It is not hard to find the story of John Sutter or Andrew Kelsey or all of these individuals. But what is harder to find is a sense of the larger whole. Mm. And so that's what I try to do with this book, to try to pull it all together, 400 years of history looming over the entire North American continent.
You write that Josiah Belden, a member of the first wagon train of Americans traveling from Missouri to California, characterized the local Indians as primitive and inoffensive, and observed that their apprenticeship in the Spanish missions had made them very useful servants and laboring men. John Bidwell of the same group pointed out that it was possible to employ any number of Indians by giving them a lump of beef every week and paying them about $1 for the same. A doctor from Massachusetts said that when it comes to California Indians, they submit to flagellation with more humility than the Negroes.
Yes. You can find many quotes like that. I mean, to me, what's really interesting, though, however, is that they were not all the same. There were differences in degree and differences in the precise arrangements in which many of these Anglo-American pioneers interacted with Native Americans. So John Bidwell, for example, that you mentioned, he used his provisions to attract Indians, but he did not resort to some of the worst excesses of Indian enslavement than others would do. In fact, he became a little bit something of a protector of some Indians who were, when they were accused of all kinds of crimes, as it happened. The other extreme is Andrew Kelsey, whose activities in the Clear Lake area are sometimes known and sometimes not known, but he seemed to have been pathological in his activities toward Native Americans, in his torturing them, completely ruthless. But the larger point is that he was able to do all of this because there was a market for Indian slavery. So even though he was ultimately murdered by some of the Indians in the region, the activities of enslavement in and around the Clear Lake area continued after his death. And there were others who resorted to a variety of techniques, and John Sutter is one of them. He used every tool in the box to try to get his Indians to work in his very significant farming operation in what is now Midtown Sacramento. So he used everything from befriending some of the leaders of the Native communities surrounding him to feeding them, giving them food in animal-like. So he used troughs where these Indians would flock into and then would get this porridge with their own hands before being driven away to work on the fields. And he also, like Vallejo, had an army, and he used this army in order to, to dissuade marauding Indians, whatever, but also to engage in the traffic of Indians, so, which he would give to some of his neighbors, sell to his neighbors. So he used, the entire gamut of the techniques used. So the point there is that not everyone was the same, and there were different gradations in the way Anglo-American pioneers resorted to these techniques.
Right, because you point out that they were accustomed to African slavery, but now confronted by the existence of Indian slavery, and they went from surprise to curiosity. Depending on their temperament and persuasion, they either accepted it or they were outraged by it.
That's right.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line. Today we're speaking with UC Davis historian and professor Andres Resendez about his new book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. And let's hear from Jeff in the East Bay. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. You've answered half the question. What was the Indian experience under the French? Because the French more or less bound with the Indians far more than the English or Spanish.
Well, first of all, we're talking about, for example, New France, right? That enormous territory in what is now, the northwestern part of the U.S. and Canada. There is a magnificent book by Brett Rushforth that details that experience. The French, you are right, they were closer to the Indians, but they also resorted to Indian slavery. What's really fascinating about the French presence is that they had a light footprint. There were relatively much fewer Frenchmen in the New World than, say, English or the Spanish, and so they depended a lot more on the Indians. Nonetheless, they did procure Indian slaves, but what's really interesting is that lasted until the 18th century, and by then they started switching into other kinds, so into African slavery as well. So, interestingly enough, and this goes not only for the French but also for the English colonies, many of these Easterners making their way across the continent in the middle of the 19th century were surprised to find Indian slaves, because in their lifetime they had not seen that in the East. But in the East, in the Eastern colonies, Indian slavery had existed in the early colonial period. It had existed in the 17th century. However, it had disappeared and had been replaced by African slavery. So that's why they reacted with shock and surprise to see this other kind of slavery, which had nonetheless existed also in the East, but had been replaced by African slavery, in part because, it was easier, much closer, easier to bring African slaves to that side of North America.
Thank you for calling in, Jeff. Let's go next to Irma in Berkeley. Hi, Irma. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My call is in regard of the way the tile roof, the tile making for the missions. I used to live in Santa Barbara, and I have visited several missions. And there's these stories about how the tile roofs, the tiles themselves, they were made on the resting on the legs of the Indians, which, by if you see the size of the tile roof, is not possible, really. They were, I think, my belief is that they were used trunks or other models, clay models, to make the tiles rest. Yeah. And so I would like to ask Professor Resendez if that's the case, or what he found.
Well, I don't have an answer for your specific topic. I mean, I don't know exactly how those tiles were made in the Santa Barbara Mission. And the evidence for enslavement under the missions is a complicated one. Indian slavery had existed by the time of the California missions for centuries before, and Indians had been used in all kinds of capacities. However, in some cases, the missions acted as brokers or as intermediaries between the slavers and the Indian communities. So some of the Indians accepted, and again, this is one powerful explanation of why Indians actually accepted to join missions is because they were escaping conditions of enslavement from other Spanish businesses. And so the missions were, they had a very clear discipline, they had a clear doctrine, etc. But they oftentimes acted as a halfway house, sort of a mediation between the slavers and the communities that were beyond the pale of European control. Sometimes, and again, I'm more familiar with the situation of what went on in northern Mexico and, say, you know, Sonora, etc. Sometimes some of the Indians who were under the bell, so they were under protection of the missions, were given away to the miners in to do draft work for a specified amount of time, with the understanding that they would come back. So this was the price they had to pay in order to be a part of the mission. So in other words, the point that I'm trying to make is that the evidence for slavery in the missions is more mixed than in other businesses that you can find in the Spanish frontier.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Irma. Cal, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask your question. How many Native Americans were enslaved in the United States and when?
That is a very hard question to answer, in part because if you count how many Indian slaves, you would have to count how many Indian slaves were enslaved by other Indians. In the United States, you have very powerful groups like Comanches and Utes who enslaved other Indians. And it is very hard to estimate the number of those Indians held by other Indians. So the best answer is hundreds of thousands, but I can't really give you to. And in any case, all of these numbers are highly speculative. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do it with the existing literature in the hopes that we'll get more refined and better estimates going forward.
And just quickly, interesting findings about Indians enslaving Indians.
Well, what's fascinating to me is that this is a whole cycle. So initially, Europeans had the upper hand because they had the better military technology, especially horses and firearms. But as these Indians acquire those technologies, some of them refashioned themselves completely. So they became different bands joined together. They became equestrian powers. They became more nomadic than they had ever been by the 19th century. And they essentially were able to prey on other Indians who did not engage in this transformation. So this is a whole cycle, a whole story that began in the 16th century with the first introduction of Europeans and played out until the 18th and 19th centuries.
It seems like we're at an interesting time right now with your book, The Other Slavery. There's a new book coming out, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe by Benjamin Madley, a professor at UCLA. I recently came across another book called Murder State, California's Native American Genocide by Brendan Lindsay. So there's a lot of new books and information coming out. Why do you think that is? Why now?
I think people are beginning to realize that this was not a sidelined or a little story. This is a big story, and there are many angles to this, and people are uncovering and becoming very interested in this subject because we are beginning to understand just the sheer scope of this.
And yet we still have so many Columbus statues, Columbus Day, although some cities are changing it to Indigenous Peoples Day. And so little information about this is in schools. We have so few museums. There was a lot of controversy when the Native American Museum opened in Washington, D.C. The American Indian Movement felt like it didn't go far enough, mm-hmm. and it should have been called something like a Holocaust Museum. So as a professor, you spent, 8 years on this book? Mm-hmm. What changes would you like to see in our society to raise awareness about these issues?
Well, I mean, one of the things I would mention about all of this is that in the process of researching and writing this book, I became convinced that there are very few innocent. This is a story in which there are Spanish slavers, there are English slavers, Portuguese slavers, but there are also Native American slavers. And the victims are on all sides. So I would hope that this is not about laying blame on each other, because everybody participated in this system in one way or another, or almost everybody. I mean, there are a few small indigenous groups that were purely victimized and were not participated. But many Native American groups, as well as all Europeans, as well as Americans and Mexicans, participated in this traffic. So I hope it's less about laying blame on the other than about trying to understand the way it worked and the way profits bent the rules. Because ultimately, what I'm showing is a system of bondage that, in many ways, you can continue a chain of stretching up to the very present. And the important lesson to draw is that this is not, so the present day type of enslavement is not something that started with globalization in the 1980s or the 1990s or with, but it is something that we have been experiencing for hundreds of years, at least for 500 years. It is extremely difficult to combat. In order to get rid of this type of enslavement, it's not enough to just outlaw it, as the Spanish did, and then the Mexicans, and then the Americans, because it continued. It really requires a very, very dynamic type of response.
Andres Resendez is a professor and historian at UC Davis. His new book is The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. Andres, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
On the Next Year Call, we're talking about music festivals. Some of the Bay Area's biggest events are just around the corner, including Outside Lands, Treasure Island, and Hardly Strictly Bluegrass. However, the number of women-fronted groups in the lineups and as headliners remained dismal in 2016, even though more women are topping the music charts and women make up more than half the audiences. So why don't music festivals book more women musicians? Who do you want to see? It's your call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.